I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. New York City is one of those places for me growing up that I knew without having been there. From all the books one's read or the film and television one's seen, that town has taken a mythical place in one's conscience, and it feels both familiar and special when one gets there for the first time. Joining me now is Skip Rosen, the noted writer and journalist, has just written a new book, The View from Apartment 4, on loving and leaving New York. It's a marvelous memoir about getting to New York as a young man of 24 with aspirations of being a writer by any means possible. It's 1965, and he takes out an apartment on 77th Street in New York City and thus begins a life in the metropolis, a single man convinced that single life is for him. Eventually, he finds a need for companionship and marries, and despite children on the way, he keeps this rent-controlled apartment as a place to work. The book shows what life with kids is like in the big city, as well how life evolves and how he leaves the city. From his perch on the Upper West Side, he sees the neighborhood change as his life changes around him. I started the book just after having returned this past summer from a vacation in New York. It's the third time I've been there in about 4 years. I can't seem to shake it off. Coming back, I read the book with such nostalgia for the place. It's fascinated me so, even for an era I would never know, a place that has been such a part of Mr. Rosen's life. Skip Rosen has written 4 books, including One Step from Glory, The Name of the Game, and The Business of Sports. He was a writer and producer on ESPN's Sports Century series. He was a travel writer for the New York Times and the Washington Post, and has had his work appear in Audubon, the Wall Street Journal, Harper's, Parents, and Business Week, among other publications. Visit skiprosen.com for more. I spoke to Mr. Rosen back in mid-October. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Skip Rosen. Mr. Rosen, good morning.
Thank you, and good morning to you.
Thanks for joining us. Did you grow up in Cincinnati?
I did. I grew up in Cincinnati and until about the age of 10 when the family moved to Florida, and from 10 till college, I was a resident of South Florida.
And then I ask that because, I mean, I'm going to ask you in a moment what your earliest memory of New York City was. I mean, that obviously came from movies or literature. Did you remember thinking about this place growing up?
My earliest image of New York, yes, there were the movies, they were all black and white at that point. Pictures of Penn Station and Yankee Stadium and Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
But when I was about 12 years old, I went with my father, who was in the paper business, to a paper convention. And that was my first experience with New York. And he stayed at the Waldorf, and I got the chance to wander through Midtown and get a sense of what the city was like, and it was quite funny for me.
He took the spoons from the Waldorf, I understand.
He did. It was a it was something. The Waldorf is his favorite hotel.
Yeah.
And I guess that, I don't know, did he want something to remember it by, or was he deep down inside just a thief? I don't know.
Yeah.
But he had these large serving spoons that that had the of the Waldorf on the handle, and it was always a little embarrassing for me later on when friends came to the house and I had to convince them that there was a long lost coat of arms of a relative. It was embarrassing for me.
So in the book you talk about what happened after college, and you spent some time in Europe, obviously, but from 12 years old on, was New York City the goal in terms of the place you wanted to live in, say?
No, it wasn't. In fact, I had no thought of going to New York. I had come back from Europe in 63, and I had served, I had been reserved for 6 months on active duty, and I knew I wanted to write. I had written in college. I wrote for the student newspaper, and then I wrote for the Miami Herald, and it was clear to me, that I wanted to write. And for some reason, and I have no explanation for this, the two places that seemed the right choice for me were the Florida Keys, is the idea of living in a rural beach setting and isolated. And other choice was New York City. And I until the very end, I debated which would be the better choice. And I was convinced by friends of mine who were older and smarter that if I went to the Keys, I would sit there and drink and get very little done. So New York was the choice.
Yeah. And so you talk in the book about finding this apartment in the Upper West Side. And you describe so beautifully what that neighborhood was like then, because it's awfully different now.
It was very much a neighborhood in transition. This was soon after Lincoln Center was built as part of a revitalization of the area, and it had not impacted that part, 77th Street, which is where I found an apartment. There were plenty of apartments. They were inexpensive. And it was, to a lot of people, a very dicey area. There was an article in the New York Times years before I moved there describing it as really a very dangerous area. But it was very much a neighborhood.
Yeah. And so you find this apartment, 336 West 77th. It's rent controlled, so the rate is good. Up until you have to leave it, which you talk about in the book. We'll talk about later. How many people lived in that building?
It was a 5-floor walk, and there were 10 apartments. So there were each of the apartments had only one tenant, with the exception of the 7th floor front had two. So there were 11 of us.
Yeah. And do you remember what you paid? What was the monthly due that first month that you got there?
The first month that I got there, the rent was $300. Well, excuse me. Let me think a second. $110 a month.
Yeah.
That was the regular rent. I did not know it was rent controlled. And one of my neighbors informed me it was a rent control building, and I wrote to the rent control commission that issued a statement that the maximum allowable rent was $68.80 a month.
Wow.
And that's what I paid.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could, by applying to the rent control commission for relief from rent control, because this was a law put in effect in World War II.
Yeah.
You could increase rent by increments every time the owner applied for relief, 7.5%, and it stepped up over the many years I was there.
And so you
slowly, very slowly.
Yeah, and so it was 2011 when you left, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, and so 2011, what were you paying then?
$300 a month.
You cut out there. What was it again, Skip?
$330 a month.
$330 a month. And so for people listening to this, you marry, you have children, you kept the apartment, obviously, but it wasn't big enough for you and your family, so you lived elsewhere, right?
Originally, we lived in a wife's apartment on 75th and Columbus, and that was basically this, you know, a one-bedroom apartment, which was acceptable for our first child,
yeah,
and ourselves, and then Julie just made if she wanted a second child, and we started looking for a larger apartment.
Yeah. I'm not going to say what happened after that, because people should read the book. I mean, I was reading it, and it was breathtaking, actually.
Thank you.
As I'm reading your book, it gets clear as we get to the present day, because you talk about, you know, what you're doing now in the sort and what life is like for you now, that someone in their 20s, as you did in 1963, couldn't do what you did then now.
True. It's true for a variety of reasons. It's true, first of all, I had this wonderful rent-controlled apartment, which permitted me to be a struggling writer, to earn very little money in order to survive, but also and this is an objective statement, the city was much more generous in those days.
Mm.
People were more writers and editors, had more time, and were less, I think, less guarded of their resources and their powers, and therefore they would reach out to writers who were unproven. I had never published a thing until I got to New York.
Mm. Yeah.
And I'd worked on newspapers, but as a freelance writer, I had only a pile of rejection letters.
Yeah, you write that in the book. I mean, I wrote down the quote, almost anything can happen once you leave New York City. These chances vanish. Because, I mean, you talk about, you know, going to parties and talking, chatting up someone who knows someone. And I mean, that's how people got work, right? Because someone made a phone call, right?
I think the connectivity of being in New York is often overlooked. Because when you're there and you're at a party or you're ice skating at Central Park or you meet somebody online at the grocery store and it's crowded. Everyone's waiting his or her turn. And conversation starts and it's just one thing leads to another.
Yeah. I guess people of this generation mistake social media for that same sort of connection, but I mean, there's no comparison, right?
I don't think that I agree with you. I don't think it applies at all.
Yeah.
Because social media is as much as you're sharing information, it's relatively isolated. Whereas when you're out there and interacting with people, there's a much more a social fluidity to it.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you about a couple of people. I'm just going to mention their names and you can tell us about them. Before I do, Look Magazine, I mean, people might recognize that, but a lot of people won't. There was a guy there named Jack Flager. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Flager.
Sorry?
Flager. Jack Flager.
Yeah. And so,
go ahead.
You talk about the connectivity of New York City. You never met the guy, but he was very important in your early years, wasn't he?
He was very important. He was an editor at Look. Look was weekly magazine, large format, like Light, competing with, and he was the fiction editor. There was a small magazine had poetry and cartoons and short fiction, I had submitted some things. I submitted to all kinds of publications. And he liked what I wrote, but he couldn't use it, and he would send it around to other publications. And the fact that I was doing nothing but failing, and yet here was this editor who believed in what I was writing and wrote me notes and didn't need to keep working.
Yeah.
And with only failure, that's very important.
Yeah. And another person in the book that you talk about is Joan Goldberg, and I think she's someone that plays an important part in your life, and I'm wondering if you'd tell us, well, as much as you'd like, because I don't want to give away too much of your book, because it is a beautiful section in the book. But just what she meant to what happened later, I guess.
Joan Goldberg was a very successful attorney in New York City who championed left-wing causes and what she felt were underserved, very active in civil rights and anti-war. And I had orders to go to Vietnam. And through friends of mine in New York, I was hungover, who was instrumental in, getting me out of that flow of activity, which was going to send me to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I was still in the active reserves, and I had my satisfy my responsibility. But she was someone who became a friend and continued to work on my business.
Yeah, and so not to get philosophical, if you will, but I mean, had you gone to Vietnam, what do you think would have happened to you?
I had a very clear vision that I would never come back.
Mm.
I had no, I was in the reserves. I was at Fort Dix, New Jersey for my 6 months active training, and then I was at Fort Polk, Louisiana. And at that time, the Army needed clerks more than they needed soldiers. And I spent all the time training physically in the military. I sat in the clerk's office and typed.
Yeah.
And when I had orders for Vietnam, it was very clear to me that I was still equipped to deal with it.
Yeah.
I had friends who were objecting on an ethical basis, and I was not one of those.
Yeah.
My position was quite, unfortunately, for my own survival.
Yeah, you weren't going to come up to Canada like some of your fellow citizens, right?
No, I wasn't going to do that.
Yeah. Well, as I was telling you, Skip, as I was reading the book, I mean, it's such an evocative book, and when you recall times from your past, I mean, even if you, the part in the book where you talk about your parking ritual, or you talk about other people at 336, these other people that lived in the building, they just come to life as I'm reading the book. These memories from the past, they're still very vivid in your mind, aren't they?
They are, and I appreciate their kind words.
What is it like for you to look back? I mean, one would assume that because of a lot of it is gone, that it might be painful. Is it?
Some of it is painful, and some of it isn't. It really depends. And people talk about hindsight being 20/20, and the truth is that hindsight is colored by our experiences between then and now. And some of the things that I said and some of the things that the decisions I made were painful, others were not. But the truth is, I made those decisions, I did those things, and I stand by them, but I'm not always happy about it.
Yeah, I guess that's writing too, isn't it? Because I get that too when you talk about your writing. It is both pleasure and pain, isn't it?
I think it's one of the great joys and burdens of writing, that when you go back over these times and think about them, it is both painful and many times humorous.
Yeah.
Situations were but the one of the great values of writing is that we chance to review these things and in the context that we didn't have at the time.
Now,
that's a value, I think.
Mm-hmm, indeed. Now, as I was telling you before we started, I'm 37, and so I'm getting close to 40. And for you, turning 40, your life changed quite a bit, didn't it? I mean, you were thinking about it as you were turning 40, weren't you, about where life was headed for you?
I was relatively self-indulgent. Being a writer, I liked the writer's life. I liked, to write, to develop stories. I like going where an assignment took me and staying as long as I needed to. I was very fortunate working for Auto Magazine that as long as I was covering the story, they were happy to support that activity.
Yeah.
And at some point, I think, frankly, turning 40, all on my own, that I could look down the road and see myself at 50 and 60. And all of that was less attractive. And I thought it was time for me to reassess and make a decision about changing some of those relatively youthful attitudes.
Because you were a single man, and you'd go on dates, and the objective of the date was a little more different after 40, wasn't it? You were looking to settle down. You were looking, and you do, as you write in the book, have to get married and have children. But there is a sense of melancholy as I'm reading the book, and I get this even before I get to certain parts of the book where you talk about subsequent events, where even in the midst of marriage and having kids, you still indulge in the experience of being solitary. You like that solace, don't you?
I do, and you portray it in a very accurate way. The part of the joy to me of being a writer is that it is a solitary act. I work in an office by myself in a desk that faces a wall. I don't look outside in at trees. I don't have a radio going. I don't engage in conversation. It's a solitary life, and I think part of the appreciation of the work that it's done alone, but it's a difficult to build a life, a social life, with that kind of attitude, and it's costly for, I think, everybody involved.
Yeah, and you do talk about that in the book, and people can read the book for what happens with regards to your family life. How did fatherhood, how did that affect your writing?
I have to ask. Initially, tried as long just as I had before we had children, and it was very difficult for me. I struggled with, I've been a freelance writer. I was generating my own ideas and then trying to sell them to magazines. I was writing books and then trying to sell them to publishers. And for me, in order to do that successfully, I needed to carve out an absolute space where there was no interference, either in parties. And that was relatively easy to do when I was married because my wife had her own life and we got together at the end of the day. But when you have children, regardless of the decisions that you're making that it's not going to impact you, it does. Mm. And it did for me. And frankly, it was a very difficult transition. I kept wanting to make it fit into the same kind of slot where it had fit before, and that just doesn't work. And I failed at it, frankly.
Yeah. I asked you a moment ago about what your life would have turned out as had you gone to Vietnam. Do you wonder what your career would have been like had you not had children, say?
No. Because having children had such a positive impact on me.
Yeah.
It was, I think, one of the most important changes in my life. We've been very lucky with our children. They're attractive and they're smart and they're interactive. And they give so much. They validate, for me, my experience as a person.
Mm.
And I don't know if you can tell from this conversation, but you can certainly tell from the book, I'm relatively selfish. I like doing what I do and when I want to do it. And being a parent challenges that. And I think the result for many of us who are parents is very positive.
So you talk in the book, about raising children in New York City and how that doesn't work, really. I mean, it's not as practical as, say, moving to a house as you eventually do on Cape Cod. One wonders, though, about the, I don't know if ethical dilemma is the right way to put it, but, I mean, you move out of the city, yet you still have that apartment. You still have apartment 4 at 336 West 77th. Was that something that you talked to a lot of people about in terms of, because it was rent-controlled as well, about keeping that place while you lived elsewhere, say?
I thought about it a lot. I thought about it a lot because I had a very good relationship with my landlord. People talk about New York landlords and how difficult they can be. I had an unusual landlord who we didn't discuss that I at some point had children and got married and was not spending as much time. It was not my primary residence. But he liked me.
Yeah.
And he let me stay there. And when we were all in New York together, I didn't really think about it. I didn't think that it was a problem, that it was not an ethical dilemma for me. But once we moved out of the city in 1991, and I was now only in and out of that apartment, not every day, that became a moral issue for me. I discussed it with a friend of mine whose judgment I valued, and he asked me if I thought the landlord knew that it was not my primary residence, and I said I was positive because his office was just a block away.
Yeah.
And my friend said that he's doing this, he wants to do this, and if you bring it up to him as an issue, he's going to be forced as a landlord, following a landlord's code, to throw you out. And I accepted that, and that was my moral balance, ethical or not. And it stayed that way until the landlord sold the building and the new landlord had no feelings for me, and I was addicted to the mud.
Yeah.
It was a horse's right.
Yeah. And what's also beautiful in the book is you talk about the relationship that you have with the apartment, obviously, but after 1991, as your kids grow up, each of them have a relationship with the place and with New York City, even though they grew up elsewhere, they went to school elsewhere, and they live elsewhere now. New York was for them very special, and it was because of that apartment, right?
If it weren't for the apartment, it couldn't have been. And they all had their own relationships with New York and with the apartment, and they write it. I quote them in the book.
Yeah.
When they were old enough to come in alone, the feeling they had of coming into that apartment and revisit those feelings that they had as children.
Yeah. Well, say, Skip, what have members of the family, what have they thought of the book? Because I mean, there's stuff in there that's obviously family history. There's stuff in there that's personal. Were they fine with the book after reading it?
Hard for me to answer that question because I don't know. It sounds strange. There are four children. They all had their own personal relationships. They're all at different stages of life. Two of them have read it and have responded. Two others are very busy, and I don't know if how much of it they read or not. I sent the book to each of them and to my ex-wife before it was published because I didn't want them to be surprised by anything in there.
Yeah.
And I told them, I can't promise I'm going to change things, but we can certainly discuss it. There were no complaints. And to be honest with you, I don't know to what degree they've been involved.
Yeah.
They've been my children, obviously, all of their lives, and they know me as a writer, and I've been doing this their entire lives. It's entirely possible this to them is just another one of Dad's projects.
Right, yeah.
But the truth is, it's hard for me to answer that question because I don't know.
Yeah. What comes through, though, Skip, as I'm reading the book is a real sense for me as a reader, just the joy of writing, and you've obviously had that throughout your life. Otherwise, you wouldn't be a writer, right?
Correct.
And so, what was it like for you to look back at your life as you have in the view from apartment 4, and write about it? I mean, was it a fun experience looking back in the sort?
Was it fun? Well, you know, writing is a combination of both fun and hell. when it goes well, it's exhilarating.
Yeah.
When it doesn't go well, it's torture. And because this book is so much more personal than anything I've ever written, that degree of balance of being painful and not painful is even more the case. So in answer to your question, it functions on, I had to respond to it on two different levels. First is the level of simply writing it and getting it right. That's right, getting a page right,
uh-huh.
And that's a matter of craft. And the other is dealing with the personal issues that I'm exploring and trying to be as candid as possible, realizing that for some people, the picture of the individual that emerges is not necessarily positive.
Now, are you, because you do contend with the personal, you are candid about your life, having written about it now, are you better off for having done it, say?
I think so. I think that dealing with these issues that are not in the middle of activity, unless you're a very philosophical person or not, one doesn't assess and make judgments about one's own decisions and behavior so much. But in retrospect, looking at it and writing it and rewriting it and getting it both accurate and clear to the reader, there's a feeling of the strong mixed feelings about the person I am introducing to the world.
Yeah. The other thing that the book is useful for, I mean, it can be a guide for people if they want to see the city the way you did. I mean, the way you describe it, even if the places aren't there anymore, it's still a good walking guide, if you will, right?
I hope so. I hope so because so much of New York, I mean, people think about Lincoln Center and they think about all the attractions and that are available at considerable cost, but there's so much that is available in New York just by walking through the city. If you know what's there and you know where to stop and look, it's one of the great walking cities in the world.
Yeah.
As are, you know, London and Paris. It's true of all these places, but New York, realize we're only Manhattan, it's one borough amongst, and the smallest of them. So the physical space that is New York is very, very small, and yet the number of attractions and what the city has done with pocket parks and with different attractions that are integral to the evolution of the city, it's a great opportunity just to take advantage of all that.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about you and Rebecca walking through, I think it's called Paley Park.
Yes.
I've been there, and I remember walking through there one time and realizing, because I saw the plaque, that it used to be where Touch Shores was, right?
I don't know.
Yeah, but anyway, so, I mean, here's a historic place that's no longer there, but, I mean, going through that space, you do feel, you know what I mean, the sense of the past as well. So you live on Cape Cod now. How often do you get back to the city?
A couple times a year. I just came back. I was there last week. I try and get in there at least. It's difficult because they don't have a place to stay. It's very comfortable for me to go there as a tourist.
Yeah.
I rely on the generosity of friends, I try and get in as often as possible. But the city's changed a lot.
Yeah.
And when you have, as I did, an apartment for 46 years, it's always available. There is a luxury to that is duplicate, and therefore it makes it clear when I'm going back how much life has changed and how much my situation has changed.
Yeah. You don't want to rent a hotel, do you? You don't want to take a hotel room because it's just it seems wrong, right?
Well, it's a statement. It makes it clear that I am a tourist.
Yeah.
And while it's true I am a tourist, I was for so long able to cling to that illusion of being a resident, even though we were living on the Cape for all those years.
Yeah.
That apartment had been there for so long, and I was so much a part of it, that accepting the very clear reality that time has changed, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah, you write near the end of the book, Skip, about how the city has changed in terms of just the attitudes. I mean, there's a scene in the book where you're at Zabar's, and you get a sense of the affluence in the city now. That's different than you know, in previous years. I mean, I live in Vancouver, and you know, we're contending with the issue of whether cities like ours are really just playgrounds now for visitors, for tourists, or people wanting to, say, park their capital. It's actually an evocative scene in the book where try to help someone at Zabar's, and just the attitude that you got from them, from shoppers there. It's obviously changing the city, and probably not for the better, right?
I certainly think it's not for the better. But the people who are wealthy, who can take advantage of these things, these opportunities, it's an improvement. I think that it's diminished because it is no longer a place the middle class can feel comfortable. Not only is real estate so expensive, is it so prohibitive to rent an apartment or buy an apartment.
Yeah.
But so many of those stores, like, you know, Klein's the Square, that offered merchandise at a reasonable price, they're gone. And not only can the working class no longer find a place to stay, they can't shop and they can't go to a restaurant. I mean, they can, but it's much more limited. The appeal is to people who can spend huge amounts of money on produce and items of clothing. You look at my neighborhood, whereas there were shoe repairs places, people now don't repair their shoes. They buy new shoes.
Yeah.
It's a different attitude. And I think it's not for the better.
I could talk all day with you about this book because as I said as we started, there are many beautiful moments in it and such great writing. This book is out now. Are you working on something else?
I am at this particular time trying to do whatever I can to promote the book and get it in front of as many people as possible, and working on a piece of fiction that I'm hoping to develop into a novel.
Yeah, well, I wish you every success with getting word out on this book and on future projects. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Skip. I so appreciate your time today. Continue good luck with the book.
Well, thank you very much for your interest. I've enjoyed talking with you.
The book is called The View from Apartment 4 on Loving and Leaving New York. It's available at all the places that you get books nowadays. Visit skiprosen.com for more information. Skip Rosen joined me on the line from someplace on Cape Cod in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.